the Saturday panel on Off the Ball.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Okay, Tyrone, The Unbreakable Bond is a brand new documentary. It's airing tomorrow night at 8:30 on TG Cahir. It's a brilliant new showing, a brilliant insight into the Tyrone minor team, specifically 1997, 1998, and then onwards into the senior success they had in 2003, 2005 and 2008. And to talk about it, I'm delighted to say Brian McGuigan, Kevin Hughes and Mark Hart are with me in studio. Good afternoon to you, gentlemen. Thanks a million for coming down to Dublin.
What? No problem.
First time in a couple of weeks, I suppose, coming down here. It's good to test the roads before next weekend. So the first things first is this documentary is obviously the hook for it is 20 years since 1998. Have those 20 years just gone by in a flash, Brian?
Yeah, well, speaking back from down the car, you know how cricket has actually went, and there were good times. There were good times, but whenever you come down the road and you're talking about babysitting and making the wife dinner, and you know it's changed times. But we look back with fond memories, and especially watching the documentary the other night, that it just brought back special times and how good times were.
Yeah, it's obviously a brilliant story, and we'll get into that in a little while, but the execution of it is excellent as well, and Mark, it helps so much that there's amazing archive footage here, and it's not archive footage, sorry, it's actually private footage that it seems is getting a public airing for the very first time.
Yeah, that's true. Even for those of us who were involved, the coalface there, there was something new. I hadn't seen a lot of the footage myself, which I think added to the programme, really. And that just, you know, was testament to the research team and Eamon and Michael Malley, obviously, and their team behind them in terms of the work they put into it. Because, you know, you kind of have that feeling that you're involved in something and that you've seen it all before. But then they were able to produce footage, and a lot of it was coming from maybe players' relatives not there, which I think made it more up close and personal, and maybe give you that insight into, like, even we're mentioning there things about on the team bus and homecomings and things like that. And I think it's nice whenever you might have seen the TV footage and that before, but whenever there's a bit more personal footage, I think it added to what was a really, really strong programme.
Whose family was doing most of the filming at the time?
Well, it was actually Stephen O'Neill's father who was responsible for a lot of the private camera work, I suppose, and they're coming from a very strong GAA family, and they followed Stephen on numerous journeys down through the years, one of Tyrone's most decorated and most talented footballers, so I'm sure they've run out of videotapes of Stephen at this stage, but it was a unique insight at a unique time in the county's footballing history.
Yeah, definitely. Kevin, obviously the reason why the story matters so much is, like, initially because of the success of the team as a minor team, but also because of the success they had with the senior team. I think 11 players from those minor teams in 97, 98 feature in 03, 05 or 08. It's an amazing turnover. It has to go down as one of the great minor stories ever.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's what we'd be proud of when the rest of the country see this, and they can see, as Mark said, the personal touch to it. It's very emotional for all of us that were involved. You know, it just starts off with any other normal minor team across the country. I suppose at that age, your ambition is to get on to the minor team, possibly do well, maybe get an Ulster title. So we were no different than any other team in the country at that time. We then, once we obviously got passed down in that and got into against Armagh, the tragedy struck then with Paul. Now, we initially thought at the time we would have a good enough team because Brian and the lads had good success in the Hogan Cup. We were in a vocational schools final as well. And then when tragedy struck there, you know, just personally, it brought the whole group closer together because you had to mature, you had to grow up a lot sooner than we initially thought. And then from there on, it was just us doing our best to in memory of Paul and going forward.
We may as well get straight into that then. It is, of course, the death of Paul McGirr you're talking about there. We have a clip from the documentary here, and this is how it's put in the documentary.
Played upfield by Brian McGuigan. Towards Richard Thornton, he's at the end of Matt Thornton.
Played a ball into Richard Thornton into the corner of the field. He came up along the end line, fist across to Paul McGirr, and him and the keeper come in a 50-50 challenge. And Paul got his hand to the ball first and in the back of net.
I was on the other side of the pitch on the terrace. We saw the goal and we saw Paul going down. And he didn't get up again.
We were concerned about him, that he was injured, and the doctor went in and various medics went in, and I'm thinking to myself, this could be broken ribs or something. We mightn't have this man for the next round. We mightn't have him for the rest of the Ulster Championship.
dahin me guru Paul Abian Akarish Della Wahimeg and Amkin a guru she Elawa Sawalcha Mayanshin Kiel Agus Marialershin Fershi Bulla Boss Agus a Gola draw on Tivina Agus Yiri Mishis Jakarish and Clehe Agus Mohim Kendak Marialershin.
So that is from the documentary there. You've heard the voices of Brian McGuigan there in English, Rita McGurr in English, Mickey Hart as well. And then, Mark, you were speaking Oscar Elga there. For people who may not be brushed up in Irish, do you just want to kind of repeat what you said there in English? That was obviously your voice there at the end.
Yeah, I suppose Paul wore number 12 on that fateful day on the 15th of June 1987 against Armagh, and I was wearing number 13. So, and Brian here, the three of us were playing in the same sector of the pitch. And when Paul went in for a ball that, you know, he ended up in an accidental collision with the Armagh goalkeeper, and the ball ended up in the back of the net. And on the scoreline at the end of the day, that was the difference between ourselves and Armagh. But like as natural, I suppose, whenever a teammate scores, you run in to celebrate. But whenever we went in that day, it became apparent pretty quick that Paul was in some distress. Now, your head doesn't allow yourself to go to places of where that ultimately ended up, but you felt that maybe there was some rib damage or a bit of an injury. But with that, we had a professional medical team at the time, and it's like any player going off the pitch, he got a round of applause going off, and in your mind you were feeling, you know, that he was in safe hands, and your mind then goes back to your job, which was trying to play your best for the team and ultimately trying to win the game with Paul in the back of your head in safe hands as far as you were aware.
Yeah, because like obviously we heard your father there saying that he thought it was broken ribs, and I'd say a lot of people that was probably the worst they thought. Like, what was your initial memory of that, Brian, when you look back on it now?
Yeah, well, like Mickey, once the game was over, I was thinking the next round, I was thinking Paul had broken ribs. It's a race against time for Paul to be playing the next day. And we had won the preliminary round a few weeks before it, and we went to Cookstown that night to celebrate the victory, and Paul was the life and soul of the party. He really was, and he was a great character to have around the team. But after that match, we went for a team meal after it, and Mickey had said to us, "Look, boys, I want you to do me a favour. Paul's up in Oma Hospital there, and if he's all before he's go home tonight, call in to see him, to see how he is, because at the end of the day, it was his goal that got us over the line." But here's me thinking, oh, I can't wait to get to Cookstown that night to celebrate the win we had. And again, it was probably one of the biggest regrets I had that I didn't go to, like I was driving past the hospital and I didn't call in to see him. And when you look back now, you felt as if you let him down, and you hear the stories from Eddie Ball and Declan McCrossan and Mickey even saying that they called to see him after the match, and to see him laying dead in the hospital bed with his throne strip on him. It just is, to think that I could have been there to see him, and it's just so scary. And look, I have two young lads of my own, and to hear Francie and Rita talking about their young lad going for a ball and never to see him again, it's scary to think that could happen when your own children wants to leave the house to go and play for Tyrone.
It's horrendous. It's horrendous from the perspective of 17, 18 year olds as well, having to go through that at the time. And like even that regret you talk about, that sort of conflict that you're going through, must be something that no 17 or 18 year old is ever prepared for.
No, and look, I never experienced death to somebody so close to me at that time. And to get the phone call that night when you were at home ready to go out to say that he's dead, you're thinking, no, it's a nightmare you're having here. And I went to the wake a few days later, and to see him in the coffin, it just hit me then and started crying. It was the first time I'd experienced it. And there were scary times. We actually had to grow up very quickly, and I think that's what helped us later on in life, that we did have to mature at such a young age, maybe something that young 17-year-olds don't have to do.
Yeah. Would that be something you'd agree with, Kevin, that there was kind of a necessary hardening of everybody in that squad there far before your time, far before any young man should have to mature in that way?
Yeah, definitely, no doubt about that. You know, when you're 17, 18, at that age, all you want to do was play football. I even say, like, even education and that would have come a close second, but at that age, all you wanted to do was play football and do your best, and you just don't think about anything else. You just think, I'm going to go out and play a game of football here, do my best for my teammates, do the best for the team. And you always expect to come out of it the other side, possibly not winning, but at worst, what's going to happen, you're going to lose a game. And I suppose when that happened to us, as Brian says, we were all getting lined up for the next day and for a night out. And when you get that phone call, it's just such a strange feeling that you can't believe that it's true. You know, you think this doesn't happen to us. You hear of this happening in other countries, other counties, whatever else, but you think, oh, it's never going to happen to us. And you feel, you even think back then when you hear those stories, you wonder, how do people cope with that? And it's just when it happens to yourself or your own teammates, you just have to get on with it. Yeah. It's the horrible truth that you just have to knuckle down and get on with life. You know, the clock keeps turning. And most definitely, it was very, very tough. It was hard to grieve at that age. But you know, you have to think deep down inside, we have to go on. We have to do what we can do in Paul's memory and for Paul's family and for us. We were probably in a lucky situation. We had a focal point. We had a distraction off the football, and we could still do something about it. We could still go on in his memory, get a few results, hopefully get a trophy, and then that would all be, obviously make it slightly easily for a family to grieve and people to get over that and to help us along as well.
Yeah, definitely. Like Mark, your father says in the documentary, which I think is just a very good line, that you had to be very careful that it didn't become a crusade, that if you didn't win an All-Ireland that year, it wasn't seen as a failure in his memory, that obviously, if you did go on to win the All-Ireland that year, it would be a huge thing in the memory of Paul McGarr. But ultimately, you can't put that pressure on you, the pressure of a young fella's memory on winning the Tom Markham Cup.
No, absolutely. I mean, emotionally, and your heart would have said, let's do this, let's win something and then dedicate it to Paul. But, you know, we were lucky. We were actually surrounded by a very sensible and experienced and professional management team. My father was there as manager, but he had surrounded himself with very good people as well. Like, we had meetings after that fateful day where the medical doctor, Dr. Cassidy, sat down with us, and, you know, we would have been, maybe some of us, worried about, can this happen to me? And, you know, he sat down and explained, you know, the chances of this freak incident ever happening again are so minuscule, they're not worth thinking about. And I think that put boys' maybe mind at ease a bit. We also had some psychological help in the form of Dr. Niall McCullough, who was able to talk us through our emotions, because teenage boys, we tend to hold on to things at that age and not express them. So there was a massive support network there, and then you'd follow Jared McAleer from a spiritual point of view as well. You know, so we were tapping into these professional people, and I don't think we were even aware of it at 17, 18 years of age, that we were getting such seriously good support to bring us through what was a very testing time at any age, never mind the tender age of 17 or 18 years of age. So there were a number of things we did. We retired the number 12 jersey, for example, for the rest of the year, which was a poignant and symbolic way of saying that, you know, Paul is in our memory every time we go out. But it certainly wasn't a case of beating chests and pumping fists about what we were going to do for Paul. But I think in the back of everybody's mind, we didn't want to say it, but we just felt if we can just get over the line and win something in Paul's memory, then maybe that would be some sort of source of comfort to the McGarr family.
Yeah, definitely. And the documentary does it in such a great way as well. Even the memories of Cormac and Michaela as well are done so sensitively. And Kevin, obviously, when we revisit the summer of 1997, like, certainly for a lot of us, the name Paul McGarr would have resonated with a lot of us, but you're kind of watching it saying, what happened there again? What was the situation? And I'm not sure if you're comfortable sharing, but like your summer of 1997, like it got worse after that. It was like, it was absolutely horrendous again. It was another step in that direction, and it was between the two Kerry games.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'd played Kerry in the drawn semi-final game in Croke Park, and obviously we drew, and the replay was in 2 weeks' time in Parnell Park. And the following Saturday in between, my brother was involved in a smash, a car accident, just a mile from home. We were going to training in Cookstown at the time, and I actually come on the accident, but it was a traffic jam. And because I knew the local roads, I just turned and took a back road. And the accident had just happened maybe 10 or 15 minutes before that. So I went on and done our training session as normal and never thought anything different. And then I was getting a lift with the boys and I got dropped off where I'd parked, or sorry, I'd called into our local bar that night just to see the lads and that there, and then they seemed very shocked to see me, and I was like, what's wrong? And then Paul Hodgkin's wife come in, Carmel come out, and she says, have you not heard the news? And I says, what news are you talking about? She goes, Paul was in an accident. So this was about maybe 4 or 5 hours later, and then I went into the hospital then. Carmel took me into the hospital, and just again, as Brian described, with seeing Paul McGarr there, I went in and They were still working on Paul at that time, and then it was about 10 o'clock or half 10 that night that he was declared that he'd passed on. So again, we were just talking to like an open operation table where he was, and he was just lying there lifeless, and you just think this can't be happening again. And obviously it was very difficult for my family and everybody at the time. My brother was in New York at the time, and my other sister was in England, and they had to travel over, and it was awful for them to carry out them journeys. But I suppose, you know, in light of all that, for me, I was probably lucky because I had that outlet, as we talked about, and it was almost as if I get back to my band of brothers here in the Tyrone Minor team, because we had went through this before. We had comforted each other, we'd got through it as a team. So I was back, obviously Mickey and Father Gerard had been to my house a good few times over there in a few days, and sat me down and talked me through it, and was saying, you know, you take as much time as you need. And I was like, no, straight away, we need to get back at it. Because I say in the documentary, and it was probably a big driving point in my decision, was in the drawn game against Kerry, when I got dropped off on the bus again at the collection spot of Paul's Quinns, and just as I got off the bus, my brother was there waiting for me. Paul was there, and he came over and just gave me the biggest embrace and hug and says, I'm proud of you, our boy. And that meant so much, because we were that sort of brothers, you know, that
typical
were
Irish
so
brothers.
So competitive. Everything was, you know, I can do better than you. My older brother John had played for Tyrone Minors in 89 and 90, and Paul was in the Tyrone Vocational Schools team, and I was the youngest, and I was going, I want to fucking do that. Like, I want to do that. And there's no doubt it's down to them where I got the inspiration. It was probably the hard days out in the backyard where they were being tough on me that it got me to the player that I was. And Paul would never have said that to me. I would always hear him. He would be managing our teams, and I always would have said, get it to Kevin, or give it into our boy. And afterwards, you know, instead of saying, well done, you could have done this better and you could have done that better. But deep down I knew that he meant it, but just to hear him say at that time, it really resonated with me. And then that was the last time that he seen me play. So when Mickey and Father Gerard put it to me about, look, we don't think you should play, whatever, I said, no, absolutely, I'm playing. I want to go back to training on the Wednesday or Thursday night. And again, we get in, it's interesting, we talk about the circle. At that time, I come back to training, and the lads, we were doing a warm-up, and then we get in and into our circle, and then it was just like I was back in the band of brothers in that circle, you know, and it was easy for me then to make that decision to play.
Because it is such a cliche, isn't it, that like something like that puts sport into perspective, but really sport almost gets an added importance. It's the coping mechanism, your circle that you leaned on, the thing that helped you through one of the most difficult periods of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, it was probably a good distraction for me and a good focus. And, you know, my family would always have followed football and would have followed me, and they never said one way or the other what they wanted me to do. They said, look, you make the decision. And I knew straight away that that's what Paul would have wanted me to do. I knew that's what the team would support me to do either way. So it was great to be able to do that. Our local club had run a couple of buses down to the match. My brother was home from New York. That was the first time he had ever seen me play then, was at that match in Parnell Park. And just it brought a bit of joy in dark times for my family and for the rest of Tyrone as well. Just that day in Parnell Park, like, it went down as one of the greatest minor victories ever.
Yeah.
You know, and to be involved in that game, and then it was so poignant after what happened that we come out on the right side of it, and it was great. It was just great for everybody after what had happened.
Like, you mentioned the Tyrone public there. Like, Brian, I'm not sure, can you kind of put into words just how great they were? Like, was there 15,000 people at an Ulster minor semi-final that year against Monaghan, I think? Like, that's outrageous support. It's a real bond all around the county, it seemed, throughout that summer of 97.
Yeah, it really gelled the whole county together. I think a lot of neutrals maybe would have been supporting us too, and you wouldn't get that now. It was a unique situation that we find ourselves in, and I know it's people say it, oh, this team's a band of brothers, but this, I think this is Mickey's vision, that we always wanted to be like a club, wanted to be like a family, and we were, and unfortunately the tragedies did bring us all close together. But we would have seen after Paul McGuire, we were like a family. Hub would have been like a brother to me. If his brother died, it was like my brother dying, and we had a row in behind him. That semi-final against Kerry, everybody's questioning whether Kevin would play in the semi-final, but we knew that we had to pull him through it. Mm. And it was up in there how Kevin would react in the match. It could go one of two ways where it would affect him mentally, but he reacted the right road and he turned in the man of the match performance in the semi-final. But ultimately, it helped us grow as people. And you could see from the tragedies that Kevin went through, especially whenever Cormac McGonagall died, we all met up after it and we said, where do we go from here? And for Kevin to stand up at the meeting that night and to say, unfortunately, boys, life goes on. Life goes on, you have to get on. You can look back with fond memories of the people that day, but that's one life away. You can't have everybody's life ruined, and we have to move on. That was special coming from him because he had been through so much.
Yeah, there's a great photo on screen at the moment of yourself, Brian and Kevin with Cormac there, celebrating with the Tom Martin Cup. I presume that's 1998. And if you look ahead to 98 a little bit, Mark, it's like Mickey was tempted to step away at the end of 97. Like, what kept him? What persuaded him that he needed another crack at this?
Well, growing up in the house, he was obsessed with the Tom Markham Cup, and there was a very strong reason for that. He lost the final in 72, and he wanted to get his hands in that cup, and the type of personality he has, he doesn't let things go that easy. So I think he'd been there since 91, and we had gotten so close in 97, and I think the leadership role he had, you know, we were all dealing with these different things individually, but collectively he had to look after very vulnerable young teenage boys in a very strange situation, and that maybe took it out of him to a certain extent as well, in that we had gotten through all of the hurdles that were put in front of us, including beating Kerry, who are so highly respected in Tyrone, it's untrue. Like, we would grow up watching Kerry golden years. We could, you know, say the commentary off by heart,
there
no problem.
There was Kerry jerseys I noticed in Tyrone minor training at the time.
Yeah, well,
Stephen O'Neill, I think, liked the sport of Kerry.
Yeah, well, there was a swap made that day after the Parnell Park game, and you know, I was always somebody who wanted to hold on to my Tyrone jersey because I wanted to give it to some of my young cousins or some of my brothers or my sister. But that day I was marking a fella actually called Martin Beckett, and he was insistent on swapping jerseys because I think everybody recognised that they were part of something special in those two games. And I would never normally swap, but I'm glad I swapped because he was actually somebody who tragically died himself in a car crash a couple of years later, who was destined for big things as well. But
a young Killarney man, wasn't
exactly,
he?
Exactly, yeah, a Crokes man as far as I can remember. But and we went down to the funeral. But in terms of the 97, it ended on a sort of a disappointing note because we had almost allowed ourselves to believe this was going to be the fairy tale ending. And if anything in life and in sport teaches you is, if you think of it and focus on a fairy tale ending, a lot of times the carpet can be pulled from under you. So maybe it just wasn't meant to be in 97. But at that stage, I think my father was sort of saying that might be end of the road. I've given it all I can. We were so close, but it's a long way back. And there was an acknowledgement from his part that maybe this was time for a fresh voice. But unfortunately, in my own case, I was overage in 98. But Brian and Kevin and Stephen O'Neill and boys like this were underage, and there was a serious pool of talent coming through. So the easiest way into my father's head is through my mother, and a couple of the boys realised that, and I think Brian and Stephen might have a bit to answer for in terms of him carrying on. So there was a meeting of minds one night, and they decided they would approach my mother Marion and sort of say, you know, we're ready to go again, we need this man involved, you have a role to play in that, can you get him to go again, and we'll finish the business. And you know, their words rang true at the end of 98.
Yeah, what was said that night, Brian?
Well, look, we just knew there was unfinished business there, and for us to get to the next level, you know, we needed Mickey there. As Mark says, the one thing that really annoyed Mickey was the fact that he lost, I think it was the 73 final.
72, yeah.
72 mm-hmm. final, and I don't think it maybe affected the teammates on his team as much as it affected Mickey that time, but it's something that he always wanted, the Tom Markham Cup, and I knew it was a goal of his, and we needed him there because he had guided us through that year. And 1988 was actually the end of a 2-year journey, and to say the 98 team won that team, or that Tom Markham, you know, it really was the 97-98 team. And if you see the t-shirts that we had in 98, Mickey was great at getting wee symbols to get us going, and on the 98 t-shirts that we had, it was 97 and 98 on it, so it really was the end of a two-year journey.
That's very interesting, I didn't know that. So it felt like kind of an extended panel. Like the third, there was a lot of people there, it seemed from the documentary anyway, that a lot of people carried over from 97 to 98. It was quite a young team in 97. Obviously, like, you weren't one of them, Mark. Like, was it, like, watching it from that vantage point 1 year later, it must have been like, God, we were so close last year. Would have loved to have been part of that team in 98 sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember distinctly my father leaving the street to go down to the 98 final and just being there with my mother and thinking, you'd love to be part of it. But I mean, we were the biggest Tyrone Minor supporters. The boys who were over age in 97, we just knew what the 98 boys, Kevin, Brian and the rest of them had been through. We had soldiered with them. They had another opportunity. And there was just an acknowledgement there that something was just right about 98. The emotional turmoil of 97, although very much still part of the team, the big focus in 98 was clearly on football. Now, you have to take into account as well that the Omagh bomb happened in the build-up to the 98 semi-final against Leitrim, which again, like, Omagh would be the county town of Tyrone and all the...
You trained there as well?
Yeah, well, the training at that stage was moved around, but all games were played there, all home games were played there, and no matter what part of the county you came from, the games traditionally were played in Healy Park and Omagh, so for the county town to have really the heart ripped out of it in that fashion, it really struck a chord with everybody involved, and suddenly there was the Tyrone Minor team cast into the spotlight again as this symbol of hope, these young men going down to Croke Park with, you know, representing the county that was at the lowest of low and in a really dark place, and yet these boys went down in 98 and just lit it up, and they were worthy champions in 98. So there was an immense sense of pride in the county again, that they had, you know, people were now suddenly talking about Tyrone for the right reasons again.
I think whenever you look back in 97, and the similar kind of story happened with Cormac in 2004, when it happens mid-season, then you're trying to finish off the season, when you have to go that extra wee bit, it's took too much out of you, you're drained. And then whenever you get the winter to kind of recharge the batteries, like 05 and 98, then you had it in you to get it. And lucky enough, we honoured them in the following years.
How did it feel for you, Kevin, given everything the lads have outlined there, getting your hands on the Tom Markham Cup in 98?
It was fantastic. You know, we knew that when you become a minor, that as I say, you might be lucky to win an Ulster Championship. And Mickey always had drilled into us as well that statistics would show that only maybe two or three players will progress onto the senior panel. So we knew at that time we've a short period of time here that we have to try our best to get our hands on it. As the lad said, we fell short in 97, and there was five or six of us went on again in 98. But I think 97 would have really helped the new lads that come in, because they would have been on the peripherals looking in at what that team had went through. We had got so close. So when them lads come in, not that they experienced it firsthand, but they knew the sort of reputation that they had to live up to. They knew how we conducted ourselves. They knew what was expected now of a Tyrone Minor team. Yeah. And just going out to win Ulster wasn't enough. And luckily, when they come on to the team, we had the experience of being there. They come in like fresh blood, and they were hit the ground running. We had done well that year. We won the Vocational Schools All-Ireland as well. And obviously, then Cormac, as their captain, was a big, big influence as well, because he was sort of mature beyond his years, and he was a great leader for us. And then it just come into place perfect for us, you know, and that's why it definitely was the end of a two-year journey for us.
Yeah, it is the crescendo, of course, of the documentary. It's the whole reason. You are listening to the Saturday panel with Brian McGuigan, Kevin Hughes and Mark Hart. The documentary is Tyrone, the Unbreakable Bond, and it's airing tomorrow night. Of course, you get one crescendo there. It's about three quarters the way through the documentary when you get your hands on the Holy Grail at the time, which is the Tom Markham Trophy. But then it goes on to another level entirely. It goes on to 2003, which is such an important year for all of you. And just mentioning Kerry again, there's a great line from Darragh O'Connaida, who pretty much straight up in the documentary says, yeah, we didn't care too much about Tyrone at the time. We didn't see them coming. We didn't have done no research on them, which I thought was kind of the very opposite of what a coy Kerry man is supposed to say. So they basically blindsided them, is what you did in 2003. Does that surprise you to hear that?
It was a surprise to hear that, you know, because obviously Kerry at the time were one of the kingpins, and you obviously just think when a team's that good, they obviously respect their opposition and really look into them and have a plan how to beat them. And but I suppose that was the mindset of people around the country of Tyrone. We had won the Ulster in 2001. We didn't really, Derry beat us in the quarter final. Sligo had put us out in 2002. So they probably thought, here's Tyrone again, won in Ulster.
Yeah.
But they can't do it on the big day. Now, for us, we had knew that we followed on from 97 and 98. Luckily again, Mickey had followed us on to the under-21s. And for us, especially in 2000, it was great for us to get that under-21 All-Ireland over the line, because it was as if the 97 team had got there along with us and they had got there All-Ireland. And then when we done back-to-back in 2001, again, it was great. But even at that stage, we were looking on to the bigger picture. I would always have drew parallels with the 95 team. That's who we would have looked at. We had been 14, 15 years at that time. And they were our heroes who we would have looked up to.
Having Peter Canavan there and stuff obviously would have helped symbolically as well.
Peter Canavan, Chris Long and the likes of those guys. Now, they had played in under-21 finals in 1991 and 92, I think, won two of them. So there was big similarities there. And we were coming up in 2002, 2003, and those lads were sort of at the end of their season. So there was big similarities there. But we were there going, we think we can go one step forward.
Yeah.
So that was our intention going against Kerry. We had the utmost respect for them, for what they had done, but we were going in to make a claim.
Yeah, I've mentioned the archive footage at the top there. There's a great news report from 2003 which we'll play you in just a moment. Now, I'd never heard this before. Actually, let's just let the news report do the talking here.
There's no doubting the great excitement among Tyrone fans in Strabane in the run-up to this year's All-Ireland GAA final. But the county colours have provoked controversy.
The council chairman says that while he doesn't support Gaelic football, he hopes Tyrone win the All-Ireland.
Flying of the flags on the public building is wrong because it can be sensitive to other sections of the community.
I think it's ridiculous. I think they should put up a flag. There's no reason why they shouldn't put up a flag, like it's their county.
The flag's not offending anybody and they've every right to put their flag up where they want to put it up.
I'm not going to lie, I didn't know there was a flag controversy that didn't involve Stormont. That's a great clip. Like the visions in the county that were brought together by football, there was still a few begrudges. Did he turn them after 2003?
Well, I suppose the nature of sport is, and sporting teams, you live in a bubble. And we were, you know, very well coached and wise in terms of keeping the main thing. There was a circus, there was distractions out there if you wanted them. And I think if we bought into all the razzmatazz that goes with the All-Ireland final and the build-up to it, maybe you don't do yourself justice. So we would like to think that we were representing every man, woman and child in Tyrone. Whether they felt that or not is entirely up to themselves. But we felt that, you know, we were carrying that red hand no matter where you came from in the county, north, south, east and west of the county. And I think a lot more positive came out of it than anything negative.
Yeah, definitely. Like, would you agree with that? Did you see a shift in society at all, or is that overplaying the whole thing?
Yeah, I think the Tyrone story has got a lot of neutrals involved. And once you get to an All-Ireland final, I think all communities watch it. They might watch it privately, but because it doesn't agree with their society. And it's funny because, like, I would think that we embrace other sports like soccer and rugby, and it's just a pity that the society of the community, there's a few people that do take it on, but something's just holding them back, the majority of them. And you just, like, every side of the community play GAA because it's such a great sport.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, talking about an evolution in society, it's the evolution as well of a team there turning from, like, boys essentially who had to go through such hardship at the end of the 90s into men who were All-Ireland champions. And I'm sure that helped along the way in terms of the bond that you had there. But I was also very interested watching this just in the context of next weekend's, the evolution of management and the evolution of Mickey Hart as a manager. We'll get your take in just a moment, Mark. But Kevin, like, I'm not sure what you saw from Mickey as a manager evolving over the years. Like, obviously, the big word is evolution when you put next weekend's game into context of what happened last year. But what did you see as a man who was, I guess, learning his craft as and becoming one of the top intercounty managers?
I think we were lucky to have Mickey at a young age. We were young, impressionable lads, and we seen a manager there who had a clear-cut vision of how he wanted his team to play. And now, don't get me wrong, first line of defence, I've said, Mickey was the first man ever to say to me, was our full forward line. And boys looked at it as I say, what the hell is this about now? And it was just really getting that mentality into everybody that you work your ass off all over the field. Now, and another thing he always said, once you lay off a pass, you don't just stand and admire it, you follow it up, you get off the shoulder, you support your teammates. And then he really instilled that into us from a young age, that we were working for each other. And as much as we helped each other in defence, as soon as we got the ball, it was all out attack. So, you know, obviously, again, Kerry in that probably was one of the defining moments, whereas Pat politely put it as Puke football, that they seen that for the first time. But we had been playing that style of football right from 97 with our minors, and that's why we seen we worked hard as a team, defending, putting pressure on, but as soon as we got the ball, we would move forward. And it was just, again, Mickey's vision. We had a game plan for Kerry that day, whereas after that, if we went to play an offensive team, we could be as offensive as them as well. So you're about evolution of Mickey, I suppose. Now, the way Donegal and Dublin of 2011 sort of up the training, defensive systems and that there, obviously Mickey has evolved, as you say, to match that. But now I think they've evolved even more, and now they're getting more offensive, and we can see that in the last few games.
Because you actually mentioned it in the documentary, Mark, some of the learnings that Mickey makes in terms of, like, looking at American basketball coaches, which is something I hadn't heard before either. So he strikes me as a man who's constantly looking to evolve. It doesn't matter how many Celtic crosses he's earned his players. It's all about going the next step and constantly evolving to be the best.
Yeah, I think if you stand still, you go backwards, whether that's as a player or as a manager, and he's no different. And I suppose his approach is very simplistic in that he wants to get the best out of the people he's working with for that period of time. And he's not somebody who gets overly excited by a victory, and he's not somebody who gets overly down about a defeat. I've seen him in the house, for example, after massive wins, maybe in All-Ireland at underage, or even some of the senior All-Irelands the day or two after he comes home, and he'll be thinking, right, when are we starting again?
Really?
You know, absolutely. He doesn't, you know, he has certain engagements that he has to go to, but it's working with the players that he enjoys. It's not the trappings that come after it. And I've seen him as well in games where you think that is a tough one to stomach, where he, in a couple of days' time after he's digested, will start be thinking about, right, I know now where we need to go. So, he, you know, every manager working at that, particularly that elite level of inter-county football, you've got to be thinking on your feet. You've got to be keeping up with the modern game, I suppose. And also, that idea of building a new team, because this is very much a new team. It's been 10 years since we got there. The only real link is Colin McKavna and Cathal McCarron, really, from 08. So 10 years is a long time. When you think back to a couple of the main players now in the team, Captain Matty Donnelly and Peter Hart, 10 years ago they were winning the minor All-Ireland.
Yeah.
And if you'd said the time was going to take 10 years for people of that quality to get the All-Ireland final, you probably would have said, no, we'll be there a bit quicker than that. But they're now 28 years of age. You've got to strike while the iron's hot. And you know, ultimately, unfortunately, you're coming up against a serious machine in Dublin. But it's a challenge that everybody in the camp will be relishing, and they'll be hoping to do themselves justice on the day.
Definitely. We'll get into that in just a moment. But one last thing. Like, how's your father going to be over the next 7 days? Is he like very agitated before a big game? Like you mentioned there that he's level enough afterwards. But beforehand, does he get nervous?
No, I mean, I think you need a certain level of nerves. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be doing yourself justice, and it mightn't mean as much to you. So there's a certain level of nerves there. But again, he's very philosophical in terms of, you know, whenever you know what you've prepared the team as best you possibly can, then you hand it over. You hand it over to the players. You've given them their instructions. You've given them the philosophy. They're now in a final and they have an opportunity, albeit against a serious outfit. But you know, his life will be the same this week coming into the game as it will be the week after it, in terms of he'll be looking after my brother Michael's children one day a week. He'll maybe be talking at a couple of engagements leading up to it, albeit that his big focus for the week will be the All-Ireland final. But he manages to keep the feet pretty firmly on the ground no matter what the outcome.
Brian, how would this Dublin team have got on in the era with yourselves and Kerry from, I don't know, 03 to 09?
I remember actually asking Mark's father at a summer camp one a couple of years ago when they're getting up for a match, and it says, how do you think the way the game has went, it's a totally different game, how would our team cope? Because we relied on maybe six forwards playing up on their positions, maybe bar Brian Doher would have tracked back, but you couldn't really play with six forwards playing up front now. And Mickey's response was, look, good players will always adapt to anything. So how this team is, and in the beginning he put it well there last week when I heard him saying that it's very hard to compare teams of different eras, but I do think that the Dublin team's a good bit away from the chasing pack. That's the best way to compare them. But we're going in the final, a one-off game. We know how meticulous Mickey is in his preparations for a final. He now has 3 weeks to prepare, and in the Super 8s in the back door, he really only had a week to prepare the team for the next game, whereas now he has 3 weeks. I'm sure he's going to have some sort of curveball there to to counteract the way Dublin's going to approach them.
Yeah, well, like, we've seen a lot of curveballs being touted over the past couple of weeks. Like, we don't know what's going to happen with Conor McKenna, for example. That's something that's been in the Irish news yesterday morning, for example. Is there any truth in that?
I think Mark was saying, Kevin was saying he's a match this weekend, isn't he? In Australia.
Yeah, I think he's his final game this weekend, but...
Nicky hasn't flown down there or anything to have a conversation with him,
not as far as we're aware. Like, I actually had Conor McKenna at school's level, and he's a tremendous player. He's doing really well for himself over in Australia. I think everybody in Tyrone with a GA connection would love to have him home and love to have him part of the thing. But it remains to be seen whether that'll be 2018 or further down the lane.
Of all the jokers your father's pulled from his sleeve before in All-Ireland, that will be number one, I think, Conor McKenna coming back before in All-Ireland. Kevin, final word to you. What do you reckon? Can Tyrone possibly do it next weekend?
Definitely. I think, you know, there's a big carrot dangling there for them. Obviously, we know Dublin are this well-oiled machine, and going into the final, Tyrone probably aren't given that much hope from the rest of the media and the country. So it's perfect for the players, because they've been knocking on the doors the last few years. They've been beating a few All-Ireland semi-finals. Each year, they're learning from their mistakes. I think that defeat, as hard as it was to take last year to Dublin, they'll have learned from it. I think our defence will have tightened up more from that. If Dublin play wide, we'll be more alert to that. It'll not be a surprise to them. I think if Tyrone can start, they've showed in clips this year, especially the first 20 minutes against Monaghan there in the semi-final, the way they attack the ball, the running off the ball, their support play, possibly the shooting let them down. But if we could see a Tyrone team doing that for 50, 60 minutes, I think we have a really good chance.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it will be an unbelievable result if they did it next weekend. You have been watching the Saturday panel. You've been listening to the Saturday panel if you're on the radio. It's brought to you this afternoon with Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. The documentary we've been talking about, in case you missed it, is called Tyrone, The Unbreakable Bond. It airs tomorrow night, Sunday night, at 8:30 on TG Cahir. Brian McGuigan, Kevin Hughes and Mark Hart, thank you very much for your company this afternoon.
No problem.
Thanks very much.
We'll take a quick break. Gary Breen is up next with a preview of all today's action in the Premier League.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.